Nothing of the sort. I found nothing that the vaccine affects prostate size in any man, never mind specifically in black men. Check with your doctor if you have any doubts, but I was able to find no such information. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com. You'll get instant access to the bonus show. You'll also get commercial-free audio and video streams of the show available every day, 6 hours before the shows are publicly made available. Sign up today, and you can use the coupon code WOW22.
CT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
RCT, in sound, from way out.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Now, Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
The Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people.
As President Biden warns of an imminent Russian invasion of Ukraine, France says Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin have agreed in principle to a summit in an effort to defuse the escalating tension. We'll speak to the nation's Katrina Vandenhoevel, a Russia expert. Plus, we look at the fatal police shooting of Dante Wright after former Minneapolis police officer Kim Potter was sentenced to 2 years in prison.
Kim Potter murdered my son, and he died April 11th. Today, the justice system murdered him all over again.
Then to Malcolm X. He was assassinated 57 years ago today in the Audubon Ballroom in New York City.
To bring about the complete independence of people of African descent here in the Western Hemisphere and first here in the United States, and bring about the freedom of these people by any means necessary.
We'll hear Malcolm X in his own words and speak to his daughter, Ilyasa Shabazz, and civil rights attorney Ben Crump about their call for a federal probe into Malcolm's assassination following the exoneration of two men who wrongfully served decades in prison for Malcolm X's death. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. France has announced President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin have agreed in principle to a summit proposed by French President Emmanuel Macron as diplomatic tensions continue to escalate over Ukraine. However, the White House said the meeting will only go ahead if Russia does not invade Ukraine, and Moscow says there are not yet concrete plans for the talks. The agenda would be set by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov when they meet on Thursday. On Friday, President Biden offered one of his starkest warnings yet over a possible invasion of Ukraine.
In the coming days, we believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people.
And do you have any indication about whether President Putin has made a decision on whether to invade? Do you feel confident that he hasn't made that decision already?
As of this moment, I'm convinced he's made the decision.
This comes amidst intensified fighting in eastern Ukraine. Two Ukrainian soldiers were killed Saturday, and Russian-backed separatists ordered evacuations of civilians, a move Ukraine blasted as a provocation and part of a Russian plan to stage attacks in the region. Meanwhile, Russia has extended military drills in Belarus that were set to end Sunday. On Saturday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called on Western nations to take stronger action, urging them to impose sanctions immediately as he spoke at the Munich Security Conference.
To me, as the president of a country that has lost parts of its territory and thousands of people, at whose border 150,000 Russian soldiers, military equipment, and heavy weapons stand, the answer is obvious. The world security architecture is fragile. It needs renewal. The rules that the world agreed on 10 years ago do not apply any longer.
Outside the Munich conference, hundreds of peace activists rallied in protest. We'll have the latest on Ukraine after headlines with The Nation magazine's Katrina Vandenhoevel. California Governor Gavin Newsom has announced his state is moving to the next phase of the coronavirus pandemic and will now treat COVID-19 as an endemic disease.
What we're announcing here today is about turning a page, moving from this crisis mentality, moving from a reactive framework to a framework where we are more sentinel our approach, that we stand firm and confident as we lean into the future, moving away from a reactive mindset and a crisis mindset to living with this virus.
Many states have recently relaxed or lifted public health restrictions after the worst of the winter's Omicron surge, though an average of more than 2,000 people are dying of COVID-19 each day across the United States. In Britain, the Queen, the 95-year-old Queen Elizabeth, has tested positive for COVID-19 and is experiencing mild, cold-like symptoms. In Canada, police arrested some 200 people and towed away dozens of vehicles clearing the streets of Ottawa of the weeks-long so-called Freedom Convoy, the anti-government trucker-led protests which started as a demonstration against COVID mandates inspired similar actions in other cities and countries. Its organizers have been linked to far-right and neo-Nazi groups. The World Health Organization announced 6 African nations will receive technology needed to produce their own mRNA vaccines. The countries are Egypt, Kenya, Nigeria, Senegal, South Africa, and Tunisia. It's part of a WHO initiative to expand vaccine access and decrease dependency on wealthier nations.
More than 80% of the population of Africa is yet to receive a single dose. Much of this inequity has been driven by the fact that globally vaccine production is concentrated in a few mostly high-income countries. One of the most obvious lessons of the pandemic, therefore, is the urgent need to increase local production of vaccines, especially in low- and middle-income countries.
In Somalia, at least 13 people were killed and 20 others wounded Saturday in the city of Beledweyne after a suicide bomber detonated explosives inside a restaurant where a number of local officials and politicians were eating. At least one of those killed was a candidate in a parliamentary election that's been delayed for months. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack. Mali's military says 8 soldiers were killed, 4 remain missing, and 14 others were injured after clashes with armed groups near Mali's borders with Burkina Faso and Niger on Friday. An estimated 57 unidentified fighters were also killed. Meanwhile, witnesses say about 40 civilians were killed in the area during recent fighting between rival armed groups. On Friday, French President Emmanuel Macron said French troops would gradually withdraw from Mali over the next 6 months. Mali's military rulers have called on France to withdraw without delay. France deployed troops to its former colony in 2013 after Tuareg rebels and groups with ties to Al-Qaeda seized control of 2/3 of Mali's territory. Talks to restore the landmark Iran nuclear deal have entered their final stretch as officials from opposing sides have expressed cautious optimism a deal may be within reach. Iran's parliament has set conditions for signing on to a new deal, which include the lifting of certain sanctions and a guarantee signatories will not unilaterally abandon the agreement as the U.S. did under Trump in 2018. This is Iran's foreign minister.
I would like to emphasize here that we are ready to achieve a good deal at the earliest possible time if the other side makes the needed political decision.
In Olympic news, Alana Myers-Taylor has become the most decorated black athlete in Winter Olympics history. She won the bronze medal alongside Sylvia Hoffman in the two-woman bobsled Saturday in Beijing, the American athlete's 5th career medal. Taylor collected more medals than any other woman in Olympic bobsledding. She also won the silver medal in the monobob at the Beijing Games. The 37-year-old is now a 4-time Olympian. On Sunday, she waved the flag for the United States in the Olympics closing ceremony. In France, a close ally of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein was found dead in his prison cell in Paris Saturday. Jean-Luc Brunel was reportedly found hanged. Brunel, a former modeling agent, was being held on charges involving the rape and sex trafficking of minor girls. He was arrested at Paris' Charles de Gaulle Airport in 2020. He frequently accompanied Epstein and was considered central to the French investigation into accusations against Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein died by suicide in a Manhattan jail in 2019. While awaiting trial. In Minneapolis, a judge has sentenced former police officer Kim Potter to 2 years in prison for the fatal shooting of Dante Wright during a minor traffic stop last April. Potter was convicted of manslaughter in December. The judge in the case said Potter made a tragic mistake when she shot Wright, a 20-year-old black man. Potter claims she meant to deploy her taser. Dante's mother, Katie Wright, spoke after the sentence was announced Friday.
Kim Potter murdered my son. And he died April 11th. Today, the justice system murdered him all over again. To sit there and watch, pouring my heart out in my victim impact statement that took so long to write, and I reread it over and over again, to not get a response out of the judge at all. But then when it came down convicting, or to sentencing Kim Potter, she broke out in tears. So once again, we are standing here to say that we're very disappointed in the outcome. This is the problem with our justice system today. White women tears trumps.
Wow.
Trumps justice.
Chicago officials have rejected the final permit for the highly contested General Iron Metal shredding plant in the city's southeast side. The area is home to mostly black and brown residents. It's a major victory for local activists whose protests included a hunger strike last year that drew national attention to the issue. A coalition of environmental groups said, quote, our community is not a sacrifice zone. This decision can be a turning point for communities of color that have been hurt by environmental racism for decades, they said. A federal judge ruled civil lawsuits against Donald Trump over his role in inciting the January 6th Capitol insurrection can proceed. Judge Amit Mehta said Trump's speech to supporters on January 6th appeared to be, quote, a call for collective action and the essence of civil conspiracy, unquote. There have been two major losses in the Pacifica radio family. In Los Angeles, Spanish-language community radio programmer Fernando Velasquez has died at the age of 73. His career spanned more than four decades. He was a dedicated producer, programmer, mentor, and organizer at Pacifica station KPFK in Los Angeles, where he served for a time as news director. And in Washington, D.C., journalist, photographer, jazz critic, and poet Askia Muhammad has died at the age of 76. Muhammad was a longtime programmer and news director at Pacifica station WPFW. His column in The Washington Informer regularly appeared in black-owned newspapers around the United States. In 2018, Askia Muhammad published the autobiography of Charles 67X, a collection of personal stories, photos, and poems about his four decades spent covering African-American culture and politics. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The French government's announced President Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin have agreed in principle to meet at a summit to discuss the escalating tension over Ukraine. The announcement came after French President Emmanuel Macron spoke with Putin for almost 3 hours. Earlier today, the Russian government said there were no concrete plans for a summit, but did not rule out that one could take place. The White House has confirmed Biden has agreed to the summit, but says it could only take place if Russia does not invade Ukraine. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov are scheduled to meet Thursday when more details about a possible summit could be ironed out. This diplomatic development comes just days after President Biden said he was convinced that Putin had already decided to invade Ukraine. This is Biden responding to a question Friday.
Do you have any indication about whether President Putin has made a decision on whether to invade? Do you feel confident that he hasn't made that decision already?
As of this moment, I'm convinced he's made the decision. We have reason to believe that.
Over the weekend, tension escalated in eastern Ukraine, where Russian-backed separatists in the Donbas region continue to accuse each other of violating a ceasefire agreement. Two Ukrainian soldiers were reportedly killed Saturday, and Russian-backed separatists ordered evacuations of civilians, a move Ukraine blasted as part of a Russian plan to stage attacks in the region. On Sunday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson addressed the situation in eastern Ukraine.
All the signs are that the plan has already, in some senses, begun. That's what our American friends think, and You're seeing these provocations now in Donbass. You're starting to see this these explosions and so on that we've been warning about for a long time. And I'm afraid to say that the plan that we're seeing is for something that could be really the biggest war in Europe since 1945, in terms of sheer scale.
In more news from the region, Russia's announced it'll keep troops indefinitely in Belarus, which is along Ukraine's northern border. Joint Russian and Belarusian military exercises were scheduled to end Sunday, but they've been extended. We're joined now by Katrina Vandenhoevel, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine, president of the American Committee for U.S.-Russia Accord. She's also a columnist for The Washington Post. Her latest piece is headlined A Path Out of the Ukraine Crisis. Well, why don't we start there, Katrina? What is that path, and how significant is what Macron has announced, agreement in principle of a summit between Putin and Biden?
Thank you, Amy. I think we're looking at two escalating forces. One is military and the other is diplomatic. I don't believe that the military jangling and noise and showdowns are effective as deterrents. I think the dangers of stumbling into a conflict if one goes down that road. But it's interesting that Macron and the German Chancellor Scholz have played important roles in these last weeks in trying to keep a diplomatic front moving. And part of the path out is something that Germany and France has been involved in for years, which is called the Minsk Accords. There's also something called the Trilateral Forum with Russia, Ukraine, and the Organization for the Security and Cooperation in Europe. But the Minsk Accords are the most hopeful. And this is providing Ukraine with independent boundaries, with autonomy, non-alignment, and assured independence. Very tough to get to. This has been endorsed by the U.S., the United Nations, the EU. And I think Macron, channeling his inner Charles de Gaulle, is showing that, you know, it's not that there are cracks in the alliance, which there are, but that there are differences. And that there is talk now not just of the NATO issue, which is so key, but also a new security architecture in Europe, which is being laid for in the groundwork of this. But the key right now, Amy, is to stop the fighting, to get to a diplomatic table, clear, persistent, tough. And I think it's important that Biden and Putin meet, perhaps even more important, Lavrov, the foreign minister, and Foreign Minister Tony Blinken. There has been, as you know, an exchange of documents, and that is being hammered away at. It has not made much progress. But these things take time, and one hopes that our media, which has not had much experience in these last years reporting diplomatic complexities, would do more patient reporting. There has been a drumbeat fueled by, obviously, imminent. I think we were supposed to have war last week, not to be light about it, because this is the most dangerous moment of U.S.-Russian confrontation, possible European war in decades.
I want to go back to the Minsk Accord. Talk about how it was developed.
It was developed in the wake of really post-Crimea as a way to build out of what is essentially, Amy, what we're looking at in Ukraine right now. Ukraine is a civil war that has become a proxy war that has been politicized into a geopolitical struggle. How to keep Ukraine as a bridge between East and West and not make it a tug, make it into a conflict zone, make it into a place where 15,000 civilians have already died. This is a country deeply divided between East and West. When you hear about separatists in the East, it is the Donbass region. You hear about the West, it's Kiev, it's other central capitals. But it was designed to keep Ukraine whole and independent, non-aligned, that there would be respect for Ukraine's language, I mean, and Russian language, which is spoke largely in the eastern side, east side of Ukraine. So I think it's tough. It's going to be hard. It needs to be monitored. But it is a way to keep Ukraine out of NATO for now. And I think one face-saving compromise is a deep moratorium on NATO expansion, certainly to Ukraine. But it's an alternative structure, just as this OSCE is an alternative to the NATO, which is a militarized structure.
And explain what the OSCE is.
The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe was founded out of the Helsinki agreements in 1975, and it has a set of buckets, human rights, economic monitoring agreements. It is an alternative structure that could have been more central than NATO. But with NATO expansion at the forefront of U.S. politics and East European politics post-1997, it's been put aside. But there are alternative security infrastructures. And I think, interestingly, Macron is framing that out, as are the Russians, not to link the two. But there is an interest in something that is less militarized and more needed for times where pandemics, nuclear proliferation, climate crisis are central to the quandaries and future of a world.
You talked about the documents back and forth between Russia and the United States. Russia published its written response to the United States last week about de-escalating the crisis. It received very little attention in the U.S. media. Can you talk about what they offered?
The documents, essentially, the Russian back and forth, obviously at the centerpiece of the Russian response is the halt to NATO expansion for Ukraine and putting that off the table. But there are other, the other, keeping U.S. weapon systems and advisors out of Ukraine, the any missile defense system, which we've paid some attention to in Europe, which has always been said by the United States was intended for Iran. Russia saw it otherwise. And beginning a new round of a very weak nuclear arms infrastructure, which was essentially unraveled in 2002, the foundational treaty being the ABM, Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. But NATO is at the core, Ukraine's at the core. But there are other issues, as I said, about halting weapons systems, halting advisors into Ukraine. And, at, you know, the heart of it, Amy, if it's interesting. You know, we should read more of our adversaries' speeches and documents and not just take it through often filtered, convoluted, secondhand. But, you know, 15 years ago at the Munich Security Conference in 2007, Putin essentially laid out what we're witnessing today. He went and he spoke not only about NATO, enough with expansion, but he also spoke about America's no longer a unipolar world. This was at the height of the Iraq War. And he also spoke about respect. And I think I have no brief for Putin. I believe, as someone once said, that demonizing Putin is not a policy. It's an alibi for not having a policy. But that Putin has become like, can we read his mind? How about reading the mind of the Russian parliament last week, which voted, the lower house of the Russian parliament voted to give independence, autonomy, to the two republics in the Donbass, Donetsk and Luhansk. Putin's press secretary and Putin have said they will not pay attention to this resolution, that it's not active. But that is a measure of public opinion among Russia's own elite blob.
So let's talk about the Donbass region. We're going to put that map up again. Talk about what's happening there, what everyone sees as the kind of flashpoint, the back and forth right now with shelling. Explain what happened in 2014 and explain what's happening right now.
So in 2014, I think it's fair to say there was an attempted coup. I mean, the United States and other forces did play a role in ousting an elected, deeply corrupt president, Yanukovych. There was an agreement to hold provisional elections. Yanukovych fled to Russia. Those were put off. Victoria Nuland, someone who comes up often, was caught on a telephone call saying F-U-C-K-U to the EU because she had her candidate. The forces in Ukraine at this moment are similar to the ones in 2014, except there's a new prime minister, but it's not clear he's his own man, Zelensky, because the right-wing forces are powerful. The freedom forces on Maidan Square have been exaggerated. There were those, but there were others. There were snipers. So then Crimea. Crimea was given to Russia, as people know, the Soviet Union by Khrushchev, the leader, I believe, in 53. There's a warm water port there. It's critical to the Soviet Union, Russia's military and other needs. There was a fear that NATO would take that port. So there was what you're witnessing today, and I talked to Russian friends, is in Moscow, there is no real appetite for taking Ukraine. It's very different than Crimea, which led to a popularity boost for Putin and patriotism and mobilization. There is polls, independent polls, and there are such Levada polls, show there's no real interest in taking Ukraine. The country is divided, Amy. It's been divided for decades. The eastern part of Ukraine, this is Donbas, Russian-speaking, is heavy industries, the steel workers, the mine workers, and this has been tied to Russia for centuries, for decades. And it's a civil war. And what we're witnessing in a humanitarian way, Amy, in the East, 15,000 casualties, and now men and women, and this is also partly due to the Russian separatists, are being put on buses, taken to Russia across the border for their safety. But people want peace and stability. And the ages of some of these people is appalling. People who are being forced to fight are losing lives. And the danger of a real war on that territory is catastrophic. And we haven't even talked about the escalatory doctrines both Russia and the United States in nuclear terms have adopted. And that these are two nuclear-secured powered countries. But humanitarian, we're looking at a crisis in Afghanistan. We are going to see another one here with refugees displaced, people of all ages being caught in, again, what is a civil war that has become a geopolitical struggle.
So let's talk about the nuclear aspect. You're talking about two nuclears here, nuclear weapons and nuclear power. What, does Ukraine have something like 15 nuclear power plants? And let's be clear, Ukraine is Chernobyl. And what it could mean if one of
I'll tell you, Amy, forgive me, but I was in touch with a very good independent Russian defense correspondent, Pavel Feigenhauer, who a few weeks ago warned, as troops massed in Belarus, and the terrain he reported from Belarus to Ukraine was not as, as easy as some have said in terms of invasion, but really dangerous, is that Chernobyl is Ukraine, Belarus, and it's still not contained. You pass by that, what could happen with upturning the still not contained nuclear power plant. So there are others there too. So that's one piece of it, as you said well. And the other is both, you know, Russia has been testing these hypersonic missiles, and the United States has nuclear-powered submarines in the Black Sea, wandering around, provocations on both sides. My concern, and I know people talk about World War II and the analogy of appeasement, I think this is far more like World War I. The stumble, the miscalculation, the trench warfare that may result, even with the super sophistication and horror of nuclear. But trench warfare is also part of this picture. But there have been provocations, as we've talked about, Amy, that have not been reported. Bomber planes 5 miles, 12 miles off the Russian border.
Who is bomber Russian, planes?
United States bomber planes, Russian. About a week ago, Amy, at the height of all of this, a Russian and a U.S. plane nearly collided over the Mediterranean, 5 feet away. This is what is accidental miscalculation, miscommunication, and then it cycles up. This is why the diplomatic process, to keep talking. Now, not everyone is engaged in diplomacy to make change toward a positive outcome. Mr. Johnson and his foreign secretary, I believe it's Secretary Truss and Foreign Secretary Lavrov emerged from serious meetings last week. He said it was a dialogue of the deaf. And I think Johnson has no interest in a new security architecture. I mean, he's living with the runt of something, Brexit, et cetera, but also is not interested in finding a diplomatic way out. And let's not forget, this is, again, about people at the end of the day. It's not just about Putin and Biden. It's about, those Russian women you spoke to last week who you know, signed a letter seeking peace. They represent those in these two countries. And finally, you know, there's talk of sanctions, right? Sanctions, sanctions, sanctions. I mean, Russia has prepared itself over these last few years. They've been hit by almost as many sanctions as exist. Of course, the SWIFT banking system could be used to take them out of it. That would hurt. But, you know, anything that's going to hurt Russia in terms of sanctions is going to possibly hurt the Europeans even more or as much, or the United States, and gas and things like that. So there's a lot of talk. In fact, there's a lot of bluffing going on about this whole situation where Biden weeks ago said, we have no national security interest and we're not going to send American men and women. So there's a bluffing that could be taken more lightly, except that this is the most dangerous confrontation between the United States, NATO, Russia in decades. And it is, no one knows where it's heading. There's a feeling of leaderlessness, even with President Biden announcing every other day that we're going to war.
Katrina Vandenhoof, I want to thank you for being with us. Publisher of The Nation magazine will link to your recent piece, A Path Out of the Ukraine Crisis. Coming up, we look at the fatal police shooting of Dante Wright after former Minneapolis police officer Kim Potter was sentenced Friday for 2 years in prison. We'll also look at the closing arguments beginning in the federal hate crimes trial against Ahmaud Arbery, who was murdered 2 years ago this Wednesday. We'll speak with civil rights lawyer Ben Crump. That's Keep On by Alpha Mist. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Minneapolis Friday, a judge sentenced former police officer Kim Potter to 2 years in prison for the fatal shooting of Dante Wright during a minor traffic stop last April. Potter was convicted of manslaughter in December. Judge Regina Chu said Potter made a tragic mistake when she shot Wright, a 20-year-old black man. Potter claimed she meant to deploy her taser. Video shows Potter shouting several times she was going to tase Wright, but her service gun, a Glock 17 semi-automatic pistol, was in her hand. She fired one shot into Wright's chest. On Friday, Judge Regina Chu broke down and cried as she talked about Kim Potter.
Kimberly Potter was trying to do the right thing. Of all the jobs in public service, police officers have the most difficult one. They must make snap decisions under tense, evolving, and ever-changing circumstances. They risk their lives every single day in public service. Officer Potter made a mistake that ended tragically. She never intended to hurt anyone. Her conduct cries out for a sentence significantly below the guidelines.
Kim Potter was ordered to serve 16 months in prison, then 8 months in supervised release for killing Dante Wright. Some had expected her to receive a 7-year sentence. Minnesota state law permits a maximum sentence of 15 years. Dante's mother, Katie Wright, responded Friday after the sentencing.
Today, the justice system murdered him all over again. To sit there and watch, pouring my heart out in my victim impact statement that took so long to write, and I reread it over and over again, to not get a response out of the judge at all. But then when it came down to sentencing Kim Potter, she broke out in tears. So once again, we are standing here to say that we're very disappointed in the outcome. Yes, we got a conviction, and we thank everybody for that. But again, this isn't okay. This is the problem with our justice system today. White women tears trumps.
Wow.
Trumps justice. And I thought my white women tears would be good enough because they're true and genuine. But when they're coerced, coached, and taught by the defense attorney, I guess we didn't have a win in this at all.
At a White House press briefing Friday, Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about Potter's sentence and expressed support for Dante Wright's family.
Well, what I can say is that Dante Wright should be here with his family and loved ones, and his death was the tragic result of a law enforcement officer's error. We know we have a long way to go when it comes to criminal justice and racial equity in this country.
For more, we're joined by civil rights attorney Ben Crump. He represents the family of Dante Wright, along with the families of Ahmaud Arbery and Kai Hussein and Malcolm X, all cases we're going to discuss today. But let's start with Kim Potter. You're right there, Ben, standing next to Katie Wright as she responds to the verdict. Can you talk about what happened? And start off with the traffic stop itself, with the air freshener on his mirror.
The example of what we believe excessive force by police officers when they interact with Black people in America. I have long said that police officers, when it comes to Black people, they always do the most. And you see that time and time again. It seems like they show such professionalism and so much consideration, so much restraint when they interact with white citizens, but when it's Black citizens, whether it is a mere lock and Breonna Taylor, where they execute these dangerous no-knock warrants in the wee hours of the night and early morning, or when it's George Floyd, who has an alleged $20 bill that's counterfeit, and they can just give him a notice to appear, it seems to be always let's do the most, and certainly with Dante Wright, where a lot of people have argued as a pretextual stop out of air freshener. And then, or they try to say it was his tag was expired during a global pandemic where there was a memo sent out saying to all the police officers in the state of Minnesota, there are going to be many people with expired tags because everything is shut down. So we are advising not to pull people over for expired tags, but yet they pulled Dante right over for a minor traffic stop, and it ended up in this death sentence. And, you know, we've often heard where they say we meant to pull our taser and pull our gun when it comes to Black people and brown people, whether Oscar Grant and others. However, you don't hear them making this mistake when it's white citizens. It's just citizens of color, they seem to make these errors, Amy. And she didn't even have to pull the taser. It's a minor traffic stop. You have the tag number. Was it really that important to pull a taser or use any excessive force over something you had already been given notice that the state DMV said, we don't want you criminalizing them because we were shut down? And so that's the history of it. And she was convicted by a jury of her peers. It was a majority white jury. And the crime that she was convicted of was not one of intent. It was one of recklessness. So it was so deflating to hear the judge say, well, because she didn't mean it, we're going to do a downward departure. We're going to give her all the consideration in the world, because in that same courtroom a few years earlier, a black police officer was convicted for killing a white woman.
Muhammad Noor.
And Muhammad Noor. And he had a manslaughter, a second degree manslaughter conviction. Him, Potter, had a first degree manslaughter conviction. Muhammad Noor, this black man, said all the same things.
Somali American.
That all the same things. Society perceived him as a black man. And he said all the same things when he shot the white woman. He was worried about his officer, fellow officer's safety. He felt remorse. He did not mean it, but yet he got no consideration. In fact, the judge sentenced him to the top of the guidelines, did an upward departure. And then when you look at this white woman killing this young black man and saying it was about officer safety and she's sorry, well, she got all the consideration in the world. She will spend less time in prison than many black people will spend in prison for selling marijuana, even though marijuana is legal in many states. And that is what has made so many people outraged, because it just seems to underscore the two justice systems in America, one for white America and another for black America.
Speaking of which, I want to go to Georgia. Closing arguments are starting today in the federal hate crimes trial of the three white men convicted at the state level for the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. Defense lawyers rested their case Friday after calling just one witness. Last Thursday, jurors were shown graphic images of Arbery's autopsy. One juror asked the judge if there was money for counseling available after hearing the racist language used by the killers, and after viewing the images of the damage to Arbery's body caused by two close-range blasts from Travis McMichael's 12-gauge shotgun. This comes after Travis McMichael, his father Gregory McMichael, former cop, and William Roddy Bryan were convicted by a Georgia court in November of felony murder and other charges for chasing down and killing Arbery. He was killed 2 years ago this Wednesday, February 23, 2020. Georgia's passed a resolution that the day will now be known as the Ahmaud Arbery Day throughout Georgia. Ben Crump, can you talk about this case? I mean, the number of times that you saw in these texts of the, for example, the man with the gun, Travis McMichael, using the N-word. That's when the juror first started saying, we need therapy in dealing with this. Talk about what has to be proved here. It's not just the murder, it's the animus, motivated by racial animus.
Yes, and that's why these federal hate crimes are so rare to have people held accountable, because you have to be able to prove that the crime, the murder, the act was motivated by race. And oftentimes you don't have text messages like the ones we see recovered from Travis and Gregory McMichael, where they seem to have a predisposition when they interact with people based on race. They talk about the protesters should all be killed, and they use the N-word in line with that. One woman testified that Travis McMichael referred to her as an N-word lover because she was dating an African-American man. You see them over and over again talk about they need to get rid of black people, that they're the problem, you know, with their job or whatever, all kind of horrific comments. And so I believe this should be enough to have the jury convict them of a historic hate crime conviction, which I believe will be the first ever in the state of Georgia.
And finally, I want to go to this other case of police brutality that you are now involved in, this horrific video emerging of two police officers breaking up a fight
between a black and a white person in a mall. The black teen, the older white teen, is pushed down, handcuffed, knee in his back. The white teen is put on the couch to sit there free. You see the older teen shoving Kai. They come to blows. 14 seconds into the fight, a pair of white police officers arrive and pull the boys apart. One officer wrestles Kai to the floor as he puts his knee in his back. The other officer pushes the white teen on the couch and motions him to sit still and then presses her knee into Kai's shoulder as well. Kai is handcuffed. The older white teen looks on, is not arrested. The video ends with a bystander's comments.
Yo, it says he's black. Racially motivated.
Kai's mother, Ebene, told CNN racism clearly played a role in the officer's disparate treatment of the two boys.
I hate to say this, but if it wasn't for race, then what is it? What made them tackle my son, not the other kid? What made them be so aggressive with my son, not the other kid? Why is the other kid sitting down, looking at my son, be humiliated, and put into cuffs? It just doesn't make sense.
Saturday outside Bridgewater Police Headquarters in New Jersey, people chanted, "We are Kai." Your final comments on this before we go to Malcolm X.
Yes, Amy, again, you see where police in America, like the criminal justice system, presumes black people to be guilty until proven innocent, and presumes white people to be innocent and to proven guilty. And in this situation, the backstory is Kai was trying to stand up against a bully to help protect his friend. But yet when the police came, the first thing they saw was young black man guilty. Let's take him down, put a knee in his back, and let's handcuff him while the white kid is allowed to sit there free and observe the black kid being humiliated. And the reason we have to have accountability on this matter is if we don't, they end up being the next Trayvon Martin, the next Ahmaud Arbery. And that's why when people say, well, he wasn't killed, he wasn't hurt, why are you all making such a big deal out of this? Is because when they wrongfully accuse our children and our people, you end up with black men staying in prison for decades, wrongfully convicted, because somebody made a presumption. And one last thing I will say, it all ties together when you think about the sentencing of Kim Potter. The judge said at the end, just put yourself in Kim Potter's shoes, a convicted killer. This is what the judge asked the citizens of society to do. I have never heard a judge say when a black person had been a convicted killer, put yourself in their shoes. That's the kind of consideration that police and the criminal justice system and American society give to white people when they have committed a crime versus when you have black people completely innocent. We still don't get the consideration. Think of Zakai. Think of Trayvon. Think of Ahmaud Arbery. And the list goes on and on.
And this is the 10th anniversary next weekend of the murder of Trayvon Martin. Ben Crump, of course, deeply involved with that case as well. Ben, we'd like you to stay with us. We'll be back in 30 seconds to talk about this 57th anniversary of the Malcolm X assassination and the call by his family for a new federal probe. Brother Malcolm by Archie Shepp and Kahil Ozabar's Ritual Trio. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It was 57 years ago today, February 21st, 1965, when Malcolm X was assassinated on the stage at the Audubon Ballroom in New York City.
not far from where we are. Malcolm's family is now calling for a federal probe into his murder. In November, a New York judge exonerated two men who spent decades in prison after being wrongfully convicted in the assassination, 83-year-old Muhammad Aziz and Khalil Islam, who died in 2009. This came after the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and the Innocence Project conducted a nearly two-year investigation that uncovered key evidence, which was withheld at the trial of the two men. Speaking in November, then-Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance apologized in court to Aziz and the family of Islam. Vance also called out former FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover.
We have obtained dozens and dozens of reports from the FBI and the NYPD's Bureau of Special Services and Investigations. These records include FBI reports of witnesses who failed to identify Mr. Islam and who implicated other subjects and suspects. And significantly, we now have reports revealing that on orders from Director J. Edgar Hoover himself, the FBI ordered multiple witnesses not to tell police or prosecutors that they were, in fact, FBI informants. Many of those documents were exculpatory. None of them were disclosed to the defense.
That's former Manhattan DA Cy Vance. He was muffled because he was wearing a mask. Muhammad Aziz, who was jailed for almost two decades, was recently interviewed by ABC News.
People knew why you were there, that you were one of the men convicted of killing Malcolm. Were there threats because of that?
To me? No.
Yes, sir.
No. The people know I didn't do it. Nobody ever thought I did it. Just white people. Our people never thought I did it.
We're joined now by Ilyasa Shabazz, one of Malcolm X's six daughters, professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, community organizer, motivational speaker, activist, and award-winning author of many books. Still with us, civil rights attorney Ben Crump, who is working with Malcolm X's family. Ilyasa, first I want to say condolences on the recent death of your sister. Your family has gone through so much pain over the years, and now you're calling for a federal probe into your dad's assassination. It's 57 years ago today. Talk about what you want to see.
Well, you used a great word, animus. We do want a federal probe. You know, my father exposed police brutality across America to the world in the late 50s and 60s. And, you know, I think that enough is enough. We want to know who killed our father, who ordered the assassination, and we want to set the record straight.
And the significance of these two men, Muhammad Abdulaziz, who is still alive, and Khalil Islam, who died years ago, both serving decades in prison, falsely convicted of the assassination of your father.
That's right. you know, again, we want to know who killed our father, and we want to make sure that it is properly recorded in history.
So, Ben Crump, talk specifically about what you want Congress to do.
Well, as Ilyasa said, we want Congress to help document the truth, just as they did with the JFK Commission, the MLK Commission, and the RFK Commission. We want them to have a congressional panel empowered to do an investigation, a complete investigation into who was responsible for planning the conspiracy to assassinate Malcolm X. We understand that based on these recent exonerations that you had not only the NYPD Bureau of Special Investigations involved, but you also had with NYPD Bossie, the FBI involved to the very top, to the FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Finally, the family deserves the truth of who killed their father. The names need to be named, and the American society and the world deserve the truth as well. And we are prepared, Attorney Ray Hamlin and our legal team, to go through every legal avenue possible to get to the truth for Malcolm X's family and to finally give them some measure of justice.
Before we end, I want to get your comments on Malcolm X himself speaking in 1964. He was speaking in the Audubon Ballroom. This was like 6 months before he was assassinated.
One of the first things that the independent African nations did was to form an organization called the Organization of African Unity. The purpose of our organization of Afro-American Unity, which has the same aim and objective, to fight whoever gets in our way. To bring about the complete independence of people of African descent here in the Western Hemisphere and first here in the United States, and bring about the freedom of these people by any means necessary. That's our motto. The purpose of our organization is to start right here in Harlem, which has the largest concentration of people of African descent that exists anywhere on this earth. There are more Africans here in Harlem than exist in any city on the African continent, because that's what you and I are, Africans.
That's Malcolm X 6 months before he was assassinated in the very same place in the Audubon Ballroom. Ilyasa, you were just two, but you were there with your mother and sisters when your father was gunned down. And every February 21st and May 19th, his birthday, at WBAI, where we began Democracy Now! And where I worked for decades, we would play your dad's speeches and talk to your mother, Dr. Betty Shabazz. And she talked about how the sound of his voice on the radio would echo through the rooms. Can you end by talking about the significance of your mother and your father together in raising you and the message they felt was most important and how they'd feel about what's happening today?
Yes, I have to say, Amy, it warms my heart. And you know, again, it's the reason that no matter where I am, when you ask me to come on your show, I don't think I'll ever say no to you. You know, my father provided the biggest critique of America with its insistence that America lives up to her promise of liberty and justice for all. I'm grateful that my parents had the love and support that they had in one another. My mother safeguarded her husband's legacy. Her home would be firebombed on February 14th, 1 week later. He would invite my mother and the babies to see him deliver his federation on the Organization of Afro-American Unity as an extension of the Organization of African Unity for liberty and justice. And my mother would watch this horrific assassination, and my sisters and I. She was pregnant with twins, and she safeguarded her husband's legacy, not so that he could be famous, but for the benefit of future generations. He did extensive work, and we know the enormous threat that he posed. And I think when we address what really happened, then young people will be able to benefit from his work. He said that it would be this generation of young people who would recognize that those in power have misused it, and that they would demand change, and they would be willing to roll up their sleeves and do the necessary work. My father spoke truth. Truth is timeless. And so we are very happy that we will soon get the truth on who organized his assassination.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Ilyasa Shabazz, one of Malcolm X's six daughters, professor now at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, community organizer, activist, award-winning author of many books, and Ben Crump, civil rights attorney who's working with Malcolm X's family. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Democracy Team, the insane from way out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, first up is Professor Henry Giroux, who talks to us about the growing reality of fascism in America.
But he doesn't think we're past the point of no return.
Next up, we speak with Roger Harris, also on the question of fascism in America and what to do about it.
And he concludes that we need, in terms of strategy, we need our own political party.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. An American form of fascism is unfolding in our country. What exactly it is and what we can do to fight it is the question of the day. We see a massive political effort to legitimize and normalize white minority rule. Things are happening rapidly. Just a year ago, our Capitol was attacked pursuant to a plan to reverse the results of a presidential election. Soon, the Supreme Court will likely overrule the almost 50-year-old precedent set in the Roe v. Wade case on the question of a woman's right to control her own body. Voting rights have been and will continue to be extremely restricted, particularly in communities of color. Irrational and magical thinking has been legitimized. Over 900,000 people have unnecessarily died of COVID. There has developed in our country a culture of cruelty manifested by Trump, but initiated in CIA torture and detention camps for Muslim men and boys in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. It didn't start after 9/11 with the wars against Afghanistan and Iraq. It goes back further than that. America has been prosecuting wars abroad during our entire lifetimes. The provocations against Russia regarding NATO military encroachment on its borders are the latest chapter in almost continual and seemingly endless wars. A lesson of history since Greek and Roman times is that if you can't have imperialism abroad and democracy at home, well, you certainly can't do them both at the same time. We speak today with Professor Henry Giroux, who currently holds the McMaster University Chair for a scholarship in the public interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department. He has written many books, most recently The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, and also the book American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Henry Giroux, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely, our pleasure. Now, you write that there's no single version of fascism. Well, how would you characterize, then, the developing fascism in America and distinguish it, perhaps, from fascism as it developed in Germany or Italy or Spain?
No, I don't think that fascism is simply of one piece. But I do think there are certain principles that get updated and take on a particular form endemic to the country in which they're being produced. And I think there are a series of warning signs, particularly in the United States and in some cases across the globe. And one is the ultra-nationalism that we see everywhere now. The other is the emergence of white supremacy as a legitimate discourse. The other is that we see what I would call the claim that America is in decline. You see the elevation of instinct over emotion. You see the attempt to suppress dissent. You see the attempt at contempt for weakness, the hypermasculinity, the culture of fear. I think the anti-intellectualism. I think what I call the politics of disposability and the claims of racial purity that we see. Also the emphasis on censorship, the rewriting of history in a way that seems to suggest that white nationalism is the only way that people can occupy, the only discourse available for people to occupy the public sphere. I think all of those issues basically represent a rebranded form of fascism that emerged.